Easter in Brussels today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Easter is normally a big deal in Brussels, but after the attacks this week, it's different.
This city is very, very tense, and it's probably going to be like this for quite a while.
Also, a century ago, there was a rebellion in Ireland against British rule, but not everyone sees the Easter Rising heroes of 1916 as heroes today.
It's my contention they had absolutely no right to do what they did, and they have given us a century with toxic violence, which has caused untold misery.
Plus, trying to renew old friendships between Israelis and Iranians.
My goal is to build a bridge between the two nations. Some people have been brainwashed on both sides to believe that the other side is bad.
Those stories ahead on The World. Thanks for being with us today. Paris and Brussels, two European capitals united in grief. And now we're finding out just how the terrorist attacks in those two cities may have been connected as well. Today, police in Belgium identified another of the suicide bombers who struck in Brussels on Tuesday. And they say he was also involved in the plot that resulted in the bloodshed in Paris last November. The ongoing investigation into the attacks is expanding rapidly in Europe. In a bit, we'll hear about one man who is linked to both attacks. But first, a lot has been said about how the Belgian authorities are struggling to deal with a lot of suspects and many leads. There are American officials already in Europe helping out, but what more can the U.S. do to help? I put that question to former U.S. counterterrorism official Juliette Kayyem.
First, it's identifying people who might be in Brussels, France, or anywhere else in Europe who might be responsible for the attacks in Paris last year and in Brussels this week. It appears that the United States may have actually been the entity, the government entity, that identified the man in the hat,
at the airport, the sole survivor.
And they're doing that by pictures, no fly list, biometric information. If we can surge that information to European officials, they can then begin to try to track him down by going to his family members and others. There's also, beyond the intelligence sharing, we're very good as a law enforcement agency. The FBI has a major presence in all of these European countries. The FBI is clearly helping both in these investigations and to thwart future attacks. And then I think the third thing, you hear a lot about it in the United States, is European officials have to be better about getting information from these communities themselves. Belgium and France and other countries have not been good in terms of integrating their Muslim communities. That's why we're seeing this kind of radicalization. So you're going to have to see at least some outreach and effort as regards better working relationships with these communities that may know a lot more than we clearly do.
When Washington looks at Europe right now, does it say our resources are limited, we're doing our own investigations on our own stuff, or does Washington say, hey, we may have limited resources, but it's important to help out the Belgians right now because that'll benefit us in the long run?
It's the latter. It's help and assist and cooperate. I mean, although Americans died in these attacks, there's no way that the United States would have primary jurisdiction. And then even if we asserted some independent authority, it would just be a sort of bureaucratic nightmare. I mean, we're working in real time now. It's clear that there's an attempt to stop attacks in Europe that may be imminent and immediate. So instead of reinventing the wheel, I think it's just a matter of surging resources at this time to help Europe in the sort of immediate crisis. I would say one thing, though, that we need to prepare ourselves. I've said this on air with you before, is there will be other attacks. This is not fatalistic. It is just to brace people for the kind of threat that we now face, which is the likelihood of being able to find every person who has the capacity to build a relatively easy bomb and go to a soft target is very, very difficult. And even if you're really good at it, it is very, very difficult. And so one of the things I'm looking at and actually been critical of is I was very surprised that after the airport attack on Tuesday that in Brussels they let the mass transportation system continue to go. Remember, the train attack was over an hour after the airport attack. No city should continue its mass transportation system after a major attack because we know these guys are working in three or four attacks. You saw it in Paris,
right.
9/11.
So that's strategic. What else is missing in Belgium and the rest of Western Europe that we have in place in the U.S.? What specific resources do they need?
They need help with border controls, and we're also good with that. We're not perfect by any means, as anyone would know, but our no-fly list, which is probably about 1,200 people who can never make it into the United States, is something that we are now sharing with the Europeans. Because if someone makes it onto the United States no-fly list, there should be a presumption that they are a bad actor. So sharing that information and who these people are, I think also serving as a liaison between Turkey, which clearly, as we know from events this week, probably knows more about who's coming across their borders than they have been sharing with Europe or that they have been getting Europe to pay attention to. That's a clear link that needs to be tightened.
How do you feel, though, when you learn about laws in Belgium that won't allow a police raid on a residence between the hours 9 and 5 a.m.?
It's time to stop being so sensitive to people's sleep, I think. And I think they're going to change all of those rules. They have to. This is their problem in the sense that if they don't solve it, it is their own citizens who are dying. You know, we lost Americans, other nationals have lost citizens. And so I think you're going to start to see a much more aggressive of law enforcement apparatus in all of these countries, supported and trained by the United States, which has a tradition of knowing how to do this.
Security analyst Juliette Kayyem teaches at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and is the author of Security Mom, which is forthcoming. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
The investigation into the Paris and Brussels attacks continues, but evidence is already emerging that the terror network behind the attacks may be much more extensive than previously thought. My BBC colleague Sikander Kermani is just back from Belgium, and he's made a documentary about the man believed to be the network's mastermind. Abdelhamid Abaoud was his name. He was killed during a police raid in Paris last November, 5 days after the attacks in the French capital.
He grew up in an area of Brussels called Molenbeek. It's an area with high levels of unemployment and a large Muslim population. I spoke to one of his friends once, and he told me that even before he became radical, he was quite the kind of person who liked to fight, basically. He was somewhat attracted to the macho glamour of that. He ended up in a kind of part of a network of jihadi extremists in Belgium, many of whom went over to Syria. But then when he was there in Syria, he seems to have kind of grown into not just an ordinary foreign fighter, you know, the likes of which there are many from Europe, but someone with a fairly senior position.
What did he do in that role as a senior kind of ISIS member?
Well, we've seen the interrogations of some returning ISIS fighters who came back to Europe from Syria. And one of them describes Abaoud as having a role within a kind of a core central group of IS, which is called the Amniyat. It's like an internal security force. It has two roles. One of it is to detect spies within IS. The other role is to basically launch attacks on the West, a kind of external operations wing. And according to this testimony of this fighter, Abaoud was one of the top figures in this group, and he would sign off on projects to attack the West. And we saw, for example, that he masterminded an attempt to attack the West that took place in early January 2015, but it was foiled when police in Belgium moved in on a safe house in the town of Verviers.
2015 was a really crazy year for all this. It seemed like the security services were just a few steps behind Abaoud and his network. How close did authorities come to actually stopping him?
Well, the authorities were realizing ever since the attempts in Verviers in Belgium in January 2015, when the authorities had, through telephone intercept evidence, discovered Abaoud's role, the authorities started realizing what a dangerous figure he was. And throughout the summer of 2015, the intelligence services began receiving reports that he was trying to obtain European passports for fighters to send them back into Europe, that he had kind of a renewed intent to attack the West. And there were a number of kind of, let's say, not missed opportunities, but times when the intelligence services were kind of just one or two steps behind him. For example, in January 2015, through telephone intercept evidence, they almost caught up with him in Greece. But by the time they pinpointed his exact location, he had managed to flee. And then he manages to escape back into Syria. He boasts about the fact that he was able to evade the intelligence services in the IS official propaganda magazine.
As you say, he set up this whole network of training for militants with European passports to go back and attack. How big is that network that he set up?
Well, I think what we're realizing now and what the authorities are realizing now is that the network that was behind the Paris attacks is actually really a lot bigger than anyone initially thought. And that it includes, you know, people who play supporting roles, logistic roles. And the current thinking seems to be that actually the attacks we saw in Brussels on Tuesday were a part two of the Paris attacks, basically. It was carried out by a second part of the same cell. So what we're seeing is that more and more figures are emerging, and more links are being brought out. Many of them are going back to Abaoud.
My BBC colleague Sikander Kermani, who's been telling us about the man identified as a mastermind behind the network of militants responsible for recent attacks in Europe. Sikander, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
So Belgium's intelligence agencies are working nonstop. Suspects and informants are being snatched up. Police raids across the continent. You can understand that the mood in Brussels is pretty tense right now. Reporter Adeline Sia was in the streets of Brussels today. Adele, tell us what you saw.
Well, at first, when you walk around, you see, in downtown Brussels or in the tourist area, you do see a lot of tourists. I met a lot of people from Hungary, Holland, France, Spain, Britain. They all said that they didn't even hesitate to come. Many of them said they had seen terrorist attacks before, and that wasn't going to stop them from traveling. So there is some life, but then you look around and the stores are not as packed as they should be.
Right. So did you meet any Belgians who were out, and are they tense?
Well, I ran into a Belgian, a man from Brussels. His name is Carl Nowellert, and he said this Easter would definitely be different this year.
Je pense qu'on a tous encore besoin de réfléchir sur ce qui s'est passé. Espérons que c'est la dernière fois.
So he said, you know, I think we all need to think about what happened. We hope this is the last time this happens. And yeah, he added that he was sort of looking forward to his mother cooking an Easter meal. And then he said that even though he's 41 years old, he's still hoping that his mother will hand him out Easter eggs that she's been giving him every year.
Easter must be a huge holiday in Belgium.
It is a huge holiday. Of course, Belgium is known all over the world as the, you know, chocolate country, basically chocolate nation. You know, it's known for its deep, its rich chocolate tradition. And apparently Easter is, in terms of sales, second only to Christmas. So you walk around and it's sort of a stark, an eerie contrast with what is going on actually in this city right now, because the shop windows are very festive. You see so many colors, Marco, giant eggs, you know, some 60, 80-pound eggs, solid chocolate eggs wrapped in colorful ribbons and wrappers, and you see people going in and out of shops. And then you realize, of course, it's not as many people going in and out of shops as there should be.
Yeah, presumably those chocolate sales are going to be kind of flat this year. How are Belgians planning to celebrate Easter after this terrible attack?
Well, I spoke to different people. You know, a lot of them are looking forward to just a family gathering and just getting together with friends and family, even if they are not particularly Christian. I mean, this is a Christian, there's a lot of Christian, sorry, there's a siren, hold on. There is a very strong Christian tradition here, but a tradition, not necessarily a religious one. It's also a tradition of just getting together for an Easter meal, an Easter egg hunt. So people were looking forward to getting together with family and maybe talk things out or not. Just being with people and sharing a moment where you could be thankful that you do have your family.
Reporter Adeline Sear in Brussels, thank you.
You're welcome, Marco.
Coming up in a bit, some lighter news from the continent, shepherds in cloaks versus lawmakers in suits, here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. This is Easter weekend, and for Ireland, this Easter marks the 100th anniversary of the Easter Rising. That was a short-lived rebellion against British rule in 1916. For many Irish, the Easter Rising is on par with the 4th of July, or in France, Bastille Day, in terms of significance. But the language of this year's centennial says it all. Officially, it's a commemoration, not a celebration. The World's Carol Hills has been looking into the Easter Rising's fraught legacy. So take us back 100 years ago, Carol. What was going on?
It's 1916. It's the middle of World War I. Britain still rules Ireland, which includes Northern Ireland at this point. It has not separated. And there's a bazillion British soldiers fighting on the Western Front, including many Irish. And the Easter Rising involved, there were seven key people who ranged from poets to socialists, and they organized an uprising, almost a coup, really, in the center of Dublin and occupied some of the main buildings. And it lasted for about 4 days, 4 or 5 days, and then they were put down mercilessly by British troops.
All right, sounds like a reason to be patriotic. What's the problem with celebrating the Easter Rising?
Well, part of it is the fact that it was in the middle of World War I. The whole of Europe, including many, many British soldiers and many Irish soldiers among them, were fighting the Germans in the Western Front. And these Easter Rising leaders were actually collaborating with Germans to try to get them to bring explosives and weapons into Ireland. Mm. So they were sort of consorting with the enemy. And the uprising did not have a lot of public support. About 1,200 people took part in it. And several hundred people died, but there were also many civilians, many women, many children. But most importantly, it's seen as possibly sowing the seeds for the Troubles, the violent period that officially ended in 1998 with the Good Friday Agreement.
Yeah, so today, what is the narrative about the Easter Rising that most Irish seem to have accepted?
Well, until recent years, it was very much like the 4th of July. This was a stand for independence of Ireland. It led directly to independence later on, that the people involved should be celebrated, worshipped, really. I spoke with Irish historian Ruth Dudley Edwards, and she remembers vividly what the standard narrative was when she was growing up.
We were taught a very straightforward narrative for the first 50, 60 years. It was never questioned. Nobody was prepared to question it. It was a career ruiner, put it that way. I don't know how many people actually did question it. But we're more mature now. There is open debate about it. I've been doing a lot of debating and interviews in Ireland. And a few days ago for a television programme, there were six of us arguing, was 1916 justified? Half and half, taking different lines. That would have been unthinkable even 10 years ago.
All right. So was it justified? What other kinds of issues, Carol, are being debated now in 2016 that never were discussed about the Easter Rising?
Some of the issues are things like, would Ireland still have achieved independence without the uprising and possibly have included the six counties in the north that became Northern Ireland, that there was a process in place, that Ireland was about to get home rule and a degree of independence after the war had concluded? Ruth Dudley Edwards told me that the most popular books commemorating the Easter Rising are things about the children who died, the women who died, the civilians who died. There's much more openness now about talking about the number of British soldiers who happened to be Irish Catholic who died. And again, people are really questioning the link between the Easter Rising and the violence of the IRA and Protestant paramilitary groups that just destroyed Northern Ireland for 30 plus years.
Here's historian Ruth Dudley Edwards again.
It's terrorism. It is terrorism. We know what it is. We know what happened in Belgium the other day. We know what is happening all over the world. It is small groups of ideologues who say we have the right because we are right and we can do anything in the name of achieving this particular aim.
Carol, thanks so much.
Thanks, Marco.
The World's Carol Hills on the centennial commemorations of Ireland's Easter Rising of 1916. And we have more on Ireland and the Easter Rising in our podcast, The World in Words, specifically how the Irish language has fared since independence. That's at pri.org/language. You might have missed this news flash recently. I certainly did. Thousands of angry shepherds stormed the parliament in Bucharest, Romania. It was a protest against a measure that would regulate an important component of a shepherd's job. Sheepdogs. My BBC colleague Lucy Ash went to Romania to investigate.
There were maybe up to 4,000 shepherds that surrounded the parliament building in Bucharest. They were trying to climb over the walls, and they looked quite strange because they were wearing these things called saricas, which are like shaggy sheepskins, four of them sewn together.
Wow.
They called them a shepherd's house because it protects you from the cold wind. Others were waving their staffs around, you know, shepherd's crooks. And they were confronted by riot police with truncheons and tear gas. So it was quite a surprising scene, really.
Why exactly were these shepherds there?
Well, they're very angry about an amendment to Romania's hunting law. It has to be recognised that hunting is a huge pastime in Romania, especially among the elite. Nicolae Ceaușescu, the communist dictator, really enjoyed going hunting, even though apparently he was a bit of a bad shot. So, I mean, it's not fair to say it's only the elite. There are people that do it from all walks of life. It's very, very popular. And there was an amendment to the hunting law which was going to limit the number of dogs that the shepherds allowed to keep. One dog on the plains, two dogs in hilly terrain, and three dogs up in the mountains. And the shepherds were very, very angry about this because they rely on their dogs to protect them from the predators that are all over Romania. They've got the biggest population of bears in Europe, 6,500 brown bears who are quite vicious when they're hungry. What the dogs do is they give the shepherds peace of mind. Otherwise, they're continually on edge, worrying that, you know, a wolf is going to come down and snack on one of their sheep or they're going to be attacked by a bear. So they didn't really like lawmakers or hunters who they see as just people who treat the countryside as a place to come and have fun rather than actually work. They didn't like them telling them how many dogs they could keep. And there was also some restriction on winter grazing.
Yeah, so tell us about the hunters. Is that part of the problem here?
Well, the hunters on their side say these shepherds, some of them don't feed their dogs properly over the winter time. They attack the animals that we want to shoot. Sometimes they actually attack our hunting dogs. One man who got out of a very fancy-looking Jeep was saying to me, do you realise that these pointers cost thousands of euros to buy and to train? It takes over a year. And these horrible shepherd's dogs attacked one and killed it. So they were very much up in arms. And they thought that, you know, there are too many sheep in Romania. They say that because of subsidies from the European Union, shepherds have, sheep breeders have been encouraged to increase the number of their flock. So it's sort of like these two lobbies, the shepherds and the hunters, are at loggerheads.
Just curious, did any of those shepherds bring their sheep to Parliament? Who cleaned that up?
No, they didn't bring their sheep. I guess if it had been France, they probably would have done, because the French farmers are very militant as well, and they quite often bring their animals down the Champs-Élysées. But they definitely brought their message loud and clear. You know, they did have pictures of sheep on their banners. They had pictures of sheep behind bars because they didn't like this ban on winter grazing. So the slogan underneath said, you know, my sheep under house arrest, you know, between January and April. So, you know, and they almost looked like sheep wearing these shaggy sarika coats, but the actual sheep stayed in the countryside.
My colleague at the BBC, Lucy Ash, thanks so much for telling us this story.
Oh, well, nice to talk to you again, Marco.
And this, it's just a little taste of 450 Sheep by the Romanian band Zdob Shizdub, only here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. After sugar and cigars, it might be Cuba's best-known export, Guantanamera. Guajira, Guantanamera.
It's a very catchy melody, and anyone can sing their refrain. All you need to know is Guajira Guantanamera or some syllables that sound like that.
Okay, so I nailed it. From Cuban folk song to Swedish recycling anthem. Ahead on The World.
Support for this podcast comes from Wonder Capital. What if you could help combat global climate change and make money at the same time? You can. Introducing Wonder Capital, the leading online investment platform where individuals can invest in large-scale solar projects across the U.S. Earn up to 11% annually while diversifying your portfolio, curbing pollution, and combating climate change. And Wonder Capital doesn't take any fees for investing your money. Join thousands who are already investing. Create an account for free at wondercapital.com/theworld. That's Wonder with a U. Wonder Capital. Do well and do good.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. John Gomeshi was a media icon in Canada. That was before he was put on trial for sexual assault charges. So it's no surprise his trial was big news north of the border. But Americans were also following the case because Gomeshi is a former host of Q, a CBC show that is distributed in this country, like The World, by PRI, Public Radio International. This was the first of two trials for Gomeshi, and the verdict is in not guilty. University of Ottawa law professor Carissima Mathen says his trial defied expectations.
people expected that the sheer weight of the number of complaints would be compelling. And then what happened in the course of the first trial is that the defense offered a lot of information to uncover some inconsistencies or some oddities in things that the complainants had said in prior sworn statements. And you had that happen three times with the three complainants, you know, very devastating cross-examination. And ultimately, the judge found that it proved fatal to their credibility.
The defense lawyer, Marie Hennion, really went after the complainants. You write that she had laser-like focus, asking for a level of detail some people saw as unfair. Tell us about those cross-examinations of the three complainants. What surfaced during that questioning?
In one case, the complainant said that she was traumatized after the assault. She couldn't bear to speak, she certainly couldn't bear to speak to him. She couldn't bear to hear his voice. And then Marie Hennion produced an email that the complainant, or two emails that the complainant had sent to John Gomeshi 6 months and a year later, which were friendly. And in one case actually included a picture of her in a red bikini. Now, that in and of itself is not relevant, but in the context of her prior statement, it was put in somewhat of a bad light.
So what were victims of sexual assault who were watching this trial? What did they hope it would lead to?
Well, I think that they hoped that it would show that the criminal justice system can vindicate claims of sexual assault. There have been notorious cases in the past with really inappropriate things being said by judges in some cases, and very aggressive tactics by defense counsel.
I mean, what you're describing scans pretty accurately with what a lot of people say about Canada's record when it comes to reporting and getting convictions in sexual assault crimes. They say it's dismal. I mean, the newspaper, The Guardian, says fewer than 10% of sexual assaults are reported. A 2012 study from your university found a conviction rate of around 0.3%. It seems the victims of sexual assault had a lot riding on this case.
I think that the notoriety of the case, you know, frankly, was a blessing and a curse because it created a tendency to view the case as emblematic of all sexual assault trials. I absolutely agree that there are systemic issues still with investigating, prosecuting, and convicting in sexual assault cases, and that is a major problem. That said, it's risky when so much of the debate is focused on one criminal case. Any criminal case is, in some respects, unique. I believe that the amount of information that the defense had in its possession going back 13 years and was unusual in a case of this kind, but it created this sense of an ambush on the complainants.
And what lies ahead for John Gomeshi?
John Gomeshi will face a second trial involving a fourth complainant in June, I believe, of this year. It will be a completely separate proceeding. So it will be interesting to see what were the circumstances around that allegation and, you know, how does the complainant survive what is sure to be another grueling cross-examination.
Karisma Mathan, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Ottawa, thank you very much for this.
My pleasure.
Tomorrow marks an anniversary for Yemen, and it's not one to celebrate, but certainly worth noting. 1 year since the start of the Saudi bombing campaign there. Yemen's civil war started long before that, but the last 12 months of airstrikes by a Saudi-led coalition has focused a lot of international attention on civilian casualties in the country, more than 3,000 in the past year. Sarah Lee Whitson was recently in Yemen. She's with Human Rights Watch and has been part of the team tracking possible war crimes in Yemen's war. What do you tell people, Sarah, who've never heard of Yemen, much less about its war or the bombing campaign?
Well, I would urge them to pay very close attention to this war in Yemen because it very directly implicates the United States. Not only is the United States the main provider of weapons to Saudi Arabia, which is leading the war against Yemen, but it's actually providing targeting assistance, refueling, and other support to the Saudi forces sitting in Riyadh Central Command, directing the Saudi war effort.
So the anniversary of the start of the bombing campaign is tomorrow. This week, the Saudis agreed to a ceasefire and peace talks next month. Why is this happening now?
Well, I think they certainly see it in their interest to avoid the ongoing bad press about their disastrous campaign in Yemen, and groups like ours that continue to expose the indiscriminate bombs which they've rained down in Yemen.
Given the U.S. involvement here, has the U.S. been putting any pressure on Saudi Arabia to come to some kind of ceasefire or some kind of slowdown of the bombing campaign?
Well, I think that would be a question better directed to the U.S. government. I know that they have told us that they have urged Saudi Arabia to be more careful in their airstrikes. And certainly some public statements of the U.S. government suggest that they believe that a negotiated solution is the only viable outcome. But Saudi Arabia has oftentimes said that, too. What I think is something we can see very clearly, without speculation, is that the actual bombardment campaign that Saudi Arabia has been carrying out with U.S.-made weapons, with U.S. support, has been calamitous for the Yemeni people and has very obviously and clearly violated basic precepts of the laws of war.
Now, Yemenis we've spoken with have noticed a pattern. Each announcement of a ceasefire follows close on the heels of an airstrike when there is a serious civilian death toll, the implication being that when there is public anger over the civilian death toll, a ceasefire is announced to distract from the criticism. Do you think that theory holds water?
There's certainly a correlation, such as immediately following the most recent strike on a market in Madaba that killed 106 civilians, in which the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, very strongly condemned. Immediately following that, there was a ceasefire announcement and the notion that there would be peace talks. Mind you, the airstrikes have continued each time a ceasefire has been promised or announced. So it's not clear at all that there's any commitment to an actual ceasefire.
Sarah Lee Whitson, the Middle East and North Africa Director for Human Rights Watch, speaking with me from Istanbul. Thank you very much for your time, Sarah.
You're very welcome.
There's a danger when we discuss war to think of it in theory and not in terms of the people who are suffering through it. No danger of that with this next story. It was sent to us by a college student in Yemen who's been in touch with one of our producers. He sent us this recording because he says he wants Westerners to understand.
Hello, my name is Ahmed Al-Ghubari. I'm from Yemen. I'm going to talk about my best friend, Bilal. Everyone in this life has a best friend, someone who knows all your secrets, someone you talk to every day, someone who can always put a smile on your face. My best friend is Bilal. Me and Bilal were playing football, watching movies, and going to school together. Bilal always knows how to make me laugh. He has changed my life and made me a better person. 3 years ago, Bilal went to the capital, Sana'a, to study there. And a year ago, Saudi started to bombard my lovely country, Yemen. On the 19th of April 2015, I went to Sana'a to meet my friend Bilal. I took him to a coffee shop. We had a nice chat, and then I went back to my house and Bilal went to his uncle's house. Saudi jets targeted Fajr Atan Mountain. It was the biggest explosion. My house windows shattered. 3 hours later, I received a call from Bilal's mother. She said, Ahmed, Bilal is dead. I said, what? I was in a very big shock. She said, Saudi killed my son. And she was crying. I cried too. I couldn't really believe that my best friend killed by Saudi airstrikes. Bilal is one of many killed by Saudi war on Yemen. I will never forget watching Game of Thrones episodes every day and dancing around his room together and singing. I hope one day I'll wake up and the war will be over.
That was Ahmed Al-Ghubari, a college student in Yemen. Not many Yemenis are holding their breath about a ceasefire leading to an end to the war. As I mentioned earlier, they see a pattern, airstrike, then ceasefire, repeat. We've got the full story at PRI.org. An extraordinary week in Cuba that began with the first U.S. president visiting the island in nearly 90 years and ending tonight with a free concert in Havana by a band that feels like they've been around for 90 years, the Rolling Stones. They'll be in front of a massive audience worthy of a papal mass. Pretty amazing for some rockers once considered subversive not too long ago by the Cuban regime. We've got a different sort of Cuban musical history for you now. It's about a song that I'm guessing you've heard, I don't know, 1,000 times, but maybe you don't know its full story. Reporter Valerie Hamilton is here to correct that.
Oh yes, you have heard this song before. Still going strong after more than 80 years, Guantanamera may be Cuba's most successful export since sugar. Guajira Guantanamera means country girl from Guantanamo. The song's roots go back to rural Cuba, but it first became famous with a Havana singer named Joseito Fernandez, who performed it on his radio show starting in the 1930s. Yo tengo como ricas. The song is not actually about that country girl. That's just a catchy refrain. But if you don't know the rest of the words, that's okay. Joseito didn't either. He made them up every week to fit with current events, kind of like a musical daily show.
He's singing about some political scandal or the price of sugar.
Peter Manuel is an ethnomusicologist in New York and an expert on the song.
He would compose on the sort of news of the day, and they would be witty and clever, and that would be the main point of it.
About the time of the Cuban Revolution, that changed. A Cuban composer took verses by the 19th century independence hero José Martí and made a kind of patriotic musical mashup with Joseito's tune. It caught on, and soon everyone in Cuba was singing it. That's how it went global. Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera. This is a recording from the summer of 1962, a year after the Bay of Pigs. A Cuban music student played Guantanamera for the American folk singer Pete Seeger at a festival in upstate New York. He loved it.
It's a beautiful song. And it's the kind which a lot of people up here could sing because it has a chorus which is not too difficult. I'd love to learn it.
He did more than learn it. He recorded it on a hit album and taught audiences all over the U.S. to sing along. A group called the Sandpipers picked it up from him. Believe it or not, their version went to number 9 in the U.S. The album came out on 5 continents, which was the 1960s equivalent of going viral. Since then, Guantanamera has been recorded hundreds of times by everyone from Celia Cruz to Jackson Brown to Pitbull, and a lot of artists you may not have heard of. There is a Soviet disco version. Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera. And a pop version translated into Japanese. Free software activist Richard Stallman recorded his own protest version, where the country girl is instead a prisoner at the U.S. camp. Guantanamero, soy preso
Guantanamero. It's a very catchy melody, and anyone can sing the refrain. All you need to know is Guajira Guantanamera, or some syllables that sound like that.
Or some that don't.
You're getting sacked in the morning, sacked in the morning, you're getting sacked in the morning.
Andy Lawn is a self-appointed historian of British football chants. It turns out that Guantanamera, refitted with insults, has been a classic in the stands of England for decades.
It's massively popular. It's probably, I would say, the most popular tune that you hear in English football grounds up and down the country. It can be anything from your support isn't very good, only less polite, who ate all the pies. It's adapted and adapted so many times, but the tune is always the same.
It's been reused so many times and in so many different ways, it's perhaps appropriate that this unofficial anthem of Cuba has become an official anthem for recycling. Sweden's Pantamera Recycling Authority turned Guantanamera into a jingle and sponsored a series of songs to go with their name, which means deposit more. We'll leave you with one of them from Swedish rappers Ohund and Third Eye, with a music video featuring plastic bottles dancing to the recycling bin. After all these years, halfway around the world, Guantanamera is still singing the news of the day. For The World, I'm Valerie Hamilton. Yeah.
som och kall. Och jag så tydligt att du behövde en hjälpande hand. Ja, du var skrinklig, smutsig och bled som
fan. And that video, the Swedish recycling anthem, even features a dancing recycling bin. Something you don't see every day. We have that video and other covers of Guantanamera at PRI.org. Purim and Nowruz, the holidays that mirror Israeli and Iranian identities. That story just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Israel and Iran are arch enemies, at least according to their leaders. But both countries are also in celebration mode this week. In Israel, Jews celebrated the holiday of Purim, and in Iran, it's the middle of Nowruz, the Persian New Year. Daniel Estrin reports from Jerusalem on how some Israelis and Iranians see each other reflected in their holidays.
This is the biblical Book of Esther being recited in the synagogue. The story is about an ancient Persian king whose evil viceroy, his representative, hatches a plot to kill the Jews of the kingdom. The bad guy's name is Haman, and every time his name is read, the tradition is to make lots of noise and boo. At the last minute, Queen Esther comes to the rescue, thwarts the evildoer's plan, and the Jews are saved. For most Israelis, the holiday is an excuse to dress in costume and party. But for some people in Israel, and in Iran, this story from the Bible is very much alive.
Both sides are making ridiculous use of the story of the Book of Esther in order to fight the other.
That's Tamar Elam Gindin, an Israeli expert on Iran and on the Book of Esther. She teaches at the Shalem College of Liberal Arts in Jerusalem. She says she was embarrassed when Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu brought up the biblical story in his contentious speech to Congress last year to urge U.S. lawmakers to reject a deal with Iran over its nuclear program. He spoke the day before the Jewish holiday.
Tomorrow night, on the Jewish holiday of Purim, we'll read the Book of Esther. We'll read of a powerful Persian viceroy named Haman, who plotted to destroy the Jewish people some 2,500 years ago.
Netanyahu called Iran's supreme leader the modern-day Haman, the villain from the Bible.
Today, the Jewish people face another attempt by yet another Persian potentate to destroy us.
First of all, assume the story is real. Haman was not Persian. He was not Iranian. He was Amalekite, which is Semite.
Okay, a minor point. But she also says that there's no historical record outside the Bible that the events of the Book of Esther ever took place. There's an older Persian legend that has a very similar plot line, and she says the Book of Esther could be a Jewish spin on that Persian tale. No historical sources outside the Bible mention a plot to kill the Jews in ancient Persia. Jews aren't even mentioned in ancient Persian sources until the 3rd century CE.
Maybe we weren't as important as we'd like to think. You know, our book survived, we survived, we're important now. But at that time, we were just another ethnic group or nationality in the empire.
Meanwhile, in Iran, Tamar says, some have cast the Book of Esther in an anti-Semitic context. There's a part at the end of the Book of Esther when, after the Jews are saved, they're given royal permission to go on a killing spree against their enemies. Tamar herself says it's not the nicest part of the book, and that it may have never even happened. But you find some references in Iran to the Jewish holiday as the holiday of killing Iranians. The Book of Esther is even called the Iranian Holocaust. This is an Iranian YouTube video that puts it in the context of the Iranian New Year holiday of Nowruz that's being celebrated now. On the 13th and final day of the holiday, Iranians leave the house and picnic. This video, as well as some respectable Iranian news sites, Tamar says, claim that the tradition recalls the ancient Persians who ran away from the massacring Jews of the biblical story. This is why we go out on the 13th day, the narrator says, lest we stay at home and be massacred. Tamar says contemporary politicized or anti-Semitic readings of the Book of Esther do not reflect the thousands of years of historical connection between Jews and Persians.
Iran and Israel were the best friends and most loyal allies until the Islamic Revolution. Jews lived in Iran in relative peace for a long time. Jews in Iran today live in peace. They usually live in good, on good terms with their neighbors. Most Iranians are not anti-Semitic or anti-Israel. The regime's official stance is anti-Zionist, not anti-Jewish.
Tamar wrote an annotated version of the biblical story called The Book of Esther Unmasked. She writes about its historical and linguistic context, the Persian word plays in the biblical tale, the biblical book's historically accurate descriptions of the ancient Persian royal court as it really was. None of this is about enmity.
My goal is to build a bridge between the two nations, because we have been allies for so much of history. For the last 37 years, because of the political enmity, some people have been brainwashed on both sides to believe that the other side is bad. So, yes, we are political enemies, and there are bad people on both sides, but the nations are not enemies. And the more Israelis know about Iran, and the more Iranians know about Israel and Judaism, you know, we just have to see we're people.
Tamar has started a crowdfunding campaign to translate her book into Persian. She wants Iranians to be able to download the book for free online. For The World, Daniel Estrin, Jerusalem.
After the bombings in Brussels earlier this week, we posted at PRI.org a reminder of all the other terror attacks that have occurred since the November attacks in Paris. It's sobering, that's for sure, and many of those other attacks did not get a lot of media attention around the globe. We also noticed a common thread that wherever attacks take place, the locals put their feet down, determined not to let terrorists dominate the story. The message? We are not scared. We are not afraid. Life will go on. And so it went in Ivory Coast, where in the coastal resort town of Grand Bassam, on a sunny Sunday nearly 2 weeks ago, a group of militants attacked bathers on the beach. 19 people were killed. But just a few days later, a group of musicians gathered on the same beach and recorded this. This is Collectif Bassam, led by singer Momo Bamba. The chorus in French goes, On a même pas peur, we're not scared, not even close. Collectif Bassam did not exist before the attack on the beach. It's like a supergroup of musicians that came together after the bloodshed and quickly wrote this tune of solidarity. As you can see in the video, a lot of people felt the same way and hit the beach to record the tune with the artists. There's a line in the song that goes, We Ivoirians don't joke around. I'd add that these musicians do know how to deal with adversity. We'll leave it there today with Collectif Bassam. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. Marco Werman here wishing you a great weekend. Back with you on Monday.
PRI, Public Radio International.